Well, it's great to be with you all, and appreciate it, Dan. Hey, you know, Greg, my friend Greg Manette was just talking about Logos Bible Software. I just want to say, and I don't make anything off of this by saying this, but I've been a Logos Bible Software user for nearly 20 years. It is a fantastic package, and it's wonderful. I carry most of my library with me on my laptop, so it's extremely convenient and a helpful resource to have for serious Bible study. Are the Gospels historically reliable? Well, before we can answer this question, we must first answer a more fundamental question. What do we mean by reliable? Now, that might seem like a simple question, but it's really not. Does it mean that in order to be reliable, there cannot be any errors whatsoever? Well, certainly that can't be the case, because if it were, well, then nothing would be historically reliable. You know, apart from Scripture, you couldn't say anything in the Greco-Roman or any literature would be historically reliable. So how many errors would be allowed before it's not historically reliable? 1%, 2%, 5%, 10%? And what kind of errors would we allow? How many big ones? Or if you have one big one, would that be the equivalent to 10 or 15 little ones in the insignificant peripheral details? How do you answer that question? And then it's more than that. It's like when you're talking about ancient biography, the genre of ancient biography is different from modern biography. It's got the same word, biography, but they operated by some different literary conventions. They had different objectives. So whereas today in biography, a modern biographer will try to talk about psychological and cultural and societal environmental items that led the person to develop into the kind of person they are. Whereas in antiquity, they believed that a person was born with a specific character. That character didn't develop over time, it's just it manifested itself more over time. So you don't have this psychological thing. That's why in the Gospels, as well as other ancient biographies, they usually talk about the person's family, ancestry, and then they launch right into the person's public life, whether it be military, politics, or teacher, whatever. And that's why the Gospels don't talk about the childhood of Jesus. It's not interested in talking about the psychological development of that person. That wasn't the objective. The objective of ancient biographers was to take the and paint a literary portrait of who that person was. And they would manifest or illuminate who that person was through their words and their deeds. Okay? So they would be selecting the material, and this portrait they're painting, they want you to get an impression of who this person was. So like Plutarch, he's the greatest of all the ancient biographers. When he's writing his life or biography of Marcus Brutus, one of the conspirators who assassinated Julius Caesar, he is painting the portrait of Brutus as a pretty nice guy. He's not brutal like a lot of the other Roman elites were. He wasn't corrupted. But Brutus wasn't innocent on a lot of things. He did some corrupt things. He was brutal at times. But in his biography of Brutus, Plutarch doesn't describe those things. He doesn't include those because it would complicate his literary portrait of Brutus. So you don't get an exact, precise, or I should say, he could be telling all truths about Brutus, but the portrait, the impression we get on who Brutus was has been airbrushed. A modern example, or hypothetical example, I should say, would be, let's say you have a modern biographer who's writing a biography on Martin Luther King Jr., and the objective of that biography is to encourage others to help the oppressed. And in doing so, that biographer talks about all the great things in the civil rights movement that Martin Luther King Jr. did, but doesn't make mention of his numerous marital infidelities, because that would complicate the portrait of MLK Jr. So let's say everything in that biography was correct, was accurate, but those marital infidelities were omitted in order not to complicate the portrait. In other words, the impression we get on who MLK Jr. was has been airbrushed. So if everything's correct, but it's been airbrushed, the impression we get is it historically reliable? How do you answer that? You could say yes with an asterisk. It requires qualification. So there's a lot that goes behind the question, are the Gospels, or for that matter, any piece of ancient literature, historically reliable? And it's a lot to get into. I can't do it right now. So rather than talk about that, I want to give you a simple definition of historically reliable as follows. At the very minimum, historically reliable means that it's preserving an accurate gist of what occurred. Now, I realize gist can have a variety of meanings to it on like a spectrum, but I'm referring to saying the literature in question gives us the main and essential parts that they are true. The main and essential parts are true. It's giving us an essentially faithful representation of what occurred. At minimum, it meets that standard. And that would apply not only to the Gospels, but to all ancient literature. When we say something is historically reliable, it at least meets that minimum standard. It might be far better than that, but it at least meets that minimum standard. That's what I'm going to be addressing in the next few moments. Are the Gospels, do they at least meet this minimum standard by what we mean by historically reliable? So in the next few moments, what I want to do is I want to give you six reasons to think the Gospels are historically reliable. Number one, we have good reasons to believe that the author intended to write an accurate account. The first thing we can note is that the Gospels are ancient biographies. Now, not all ancient biographers were so committed to accuracy. So this only takes us so far, but it does tell us that it is a historical genre. They are not written as ancient novels, okay? Now, some characteristics of ancient biography. Here's why the majority of New Testament scholars today regard the Gospels as ancient biographies. Number one, they focus on the main character. When a history is being written, the difference between a biography and a history is a history focuses on an era, an event, or like a government, what's going on, whereas a biography focuses on a person. It's still historical literature, but one is called a history, the other is called a biography. Number two, as I mentioned a few moments ago, in ancient biographies, the biographer in ancient biography starts off with the person's ancestry and then launches into the person's public life. Skip over the childhood in most cases. In fact, with Jesus, the only event that's reported about his childhood is a single event when he was 12 in the Gospel of Luke that his parents had left from Passover and they're headed back home to Nazareth. And, hey, where's Jesus? And they have to go back to Jerusalem and they see him in the temple at age 12. That's the only event we have of Jesus' childhood. Why not more? Because it's an ancient biography. They're not concerned with the person's childhood. Third, the main subject's character, as I mentioned, is illuminated through the words and deeds in that portrait. Okay. Fourth, the length of the biography was typically 10 to 25,000 words. You could fit, almost as a max as 25,000 words on a scroll. You might be able to fit more in, but typically 10 to 25,000 words on a scroll is what you would get. So you can see the number of Greek words here in each of the Gospels. Mark is the shortest at a little over 11,000 words, and then you have Luke as the longest at a little over 19,000 words, so they fit right in with the typical length of biographies. They're not ancient novels. Why do scholars across the board reject that the Gospels aren't ancient novels? That's not to say there aren't any who think that they're novels. You'll find a few scholars who deny the Holocaust out there. You could fit them probably on a single hand, count them on a single hand, but there are a few that would do that. There are a few on a single hand, perhaps, that would deny that Jesus ever existed, but typically they aren't respected historians. Ancient novels, why aren't the Gospels ancient novels? Because ancient novels typically involved romances in which two lovers had to overcome obstacles. And unless you believe the Da Vinci Code, There's nothing to suggest that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had a fling going on. There's no romance in the Gospels. Also, in ancient novels, typically involved entirely fictitious characters who had supposedly existed in the distant past. That is not what we have in the Gospels. Rarely, but on occasion, you will find an ancient novel that mentions a historical character, but there isn't a single ancient novel in which that character had lived within even as recent as a century of the writing of that novel. Yet, in the Gospels, you've got historical characters like Caesar Augustus, Tiberius Caesar, Herod the Great, Herod Philip, Herod Antipas, Herod Archelaus, Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas, Jesus, John the Baptist. All of these are known to be historical characters and written less than a century within the time in which these people existed. So it's a biographical genre in which the Gospels are written. Again, you want something like that, of course, but that only goes so far. But it does show that there's historical intent. More of historical intent as we see what the authors themselves say about what they're writing. So in the Gospel of Luke, at the very beginning, he says, "It seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know for certain the things you have been taught." So Luke is stating he's trying to report the facts about Jesus. You got the Gospel of John, who says, "And the one who has seen has testified, his testimony is true, and he knows he is telling the truth, so that you may also believe." John says he is telling the truth about Jesus. That's something that's kind of interesting in the Gospel of Mark. He's talking about Simon of Cyrene, who helped carry Jesus' cross, and he says, "The soldiers forced the passerby to carry Jesus' cross, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, who was coming in from the country." And many scholars, you'll read it in the commentaries, they will say that this suggests that Mark's audience, the readers or listeners, would have known Alexander and Rufus, and so they would have known about their father, Simon of Cyrene, and go, "Oh, yeah, we know him. We know who you're talking about there." There's no contemporary competing portraits of Jesus outside the Gospels, at least within a short period of time. So just a little timeline here. You've got in the first century, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they present a portrait of Jesus. He is the divine Son of God. Then you come into the second century. You have the Edgerton Papyrus. You have the Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Mary. These come around the middle of the second century and later. They present a little bit different portrait. But again, they're second century, mid and late second century. Then you come to the year around 200, between 200 and later you've got the Gospel of Philip and then the secret Gospel of Mark around the year 1958, which seems to have been a fraud, a forgery. So we have good reasons to think that intended to write accurate history. Second, the authors chose their sources judiciously. They just weren't haphazard in taking any source out there. So according to the traditional authorship of the Gospels, Mark got his information from Peter. He wrote down what he recalled Peter saying. If that's true, that's pretty cool. Luke, most scholars think that he got his information. He's using Mark as a primary source, and he is supplementing that. And remember, Luke says that there were many who had written accounts, and he's relying on what eyewitnesses and those who had known the eyewitnesses are saying. So he's getting his information from Mark. Then you've got what's called the hypothetical Q source. Now, how many have heard of Q? You've even heard it mentioned. Okay, a lot of you. Let me explain what Q is. It's a hypothetical source based on, now I'm going to oversimplify this, but typically most scholars today think that Mark was the first gospel written, and that Matthew and Luke used Mark as their primary source and then supplemented it with their own either eyewitness testimony or other sources that they had. So if you see almost verbatim recollection of facts in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, scholars typically think that they're using Matthew and Luke are using Mark as their primary source there. But what happens when you have virtually verbatim repetition between Matthew and Luke, but it's not even in Mark? They can't be using Mark. Well, you've got one of three options. Either Matthew and Luke are using a common drawing from a common source, or Luke is using Matthew, or Matthew is using Luke. Well, most New Testament scholars today think that Matthew and Luke are using a common source that we no longer have. And so the German scholar who came up with this hypothesis, he what do you call this hypothetical source? Well, the German word for source is Quelle. So you just abbreviate that as Q. That's all Q is. It's not Gnostic source or anything. It's just a hypothetical source that Matthew and Luke would have used. So now some scholars think that Luke used Matthew, or Matthew, a very small minority think Matthew used Luke. They might be right. We just don't know. It's all what's called the synoptic problem, trying to figure all this out, okay? But most scholars today think the Q source. And then they would say that Luke drew some information from Paul, especially in the book of Acts, and then other eyewitnesses. John, the traditional authorship is that he was one of the 12 disciples, and of course he was an eyewitness. And then you've got Matthew, traditional. Well, today, most scholars think that he used Mark as a source, and Q, and at least one other, which could have been eyewitness testimony from Matthew to supplement. Number three, the author used sources responsibly. Do we have evidence that the authors of the Gospels used their sources responsibly? Well, here we can compare how Plutarch and Josephus use their sources. This is interesting to do. Josephus and Plutarch give us unique opportunities because we've got some of their sources. And so we can see how they use those sources. And we see that they will adapt their sources. They edit them. They will supplement their sources. But they stay fairly close to their sources. Now, we can do that with the Gospels as well, and we can compare how, let's say, Matthew and Luke use Mark, and we see that they stay closer to Mark than what Josephus and Plutarch does with their sources. So that's pretty cool. Why are they doing that? Technically, if they're writing good biography, they ought to adapt their sources, paraphrase them more. They shouldn't do verbatim repetition. That was a no-no. But a lot of times Matthew and Luke do that with Mark. Why? Well, maybe it's because they had such high regard for Mark that they took minimal liberties in editing his account. Number four, we want to know that the authors or their sources were capable of recalling history accurately. Now, when we're talking about Plutarch, and he's regarded as the greatest of the ancient biographers. This is the real. This isn't the Plutarch of the Hunger Games. This is the Plutarch that was born right around the year 40 and died just after the year 120. So he's living during the same time as the apostles. He's writing shortly after the Gospel of John, and he's writing in the same language. He wrote over 60 biographies, of which 48 have survived. And we learn a lot from the ancient world from Plutarch. Plutarch, he talks, when he's writing his biographies of Caesar, Cicero, Brutus, Antony, and some others, he's writing within 140 years of the events he's describing. And he says he's got good information, good sources, so he can report on these. But later on, he's going to write on Theseus, the legendary founder of Greece, and Romulus, the legendary founder of, I'll bet you'll never guess. That's right, Rome. But they are alleged to have existed 800 to 1,000 years before Plutarch is writing. That's a lot further removed from Plutarch. So here's what Plutarch says. After he writes these, he's already written about Caesar, Cicero, and Antony, and Brutus, and others, and he says, "Now that I have traversed those periods of time which are accessible to probable reasoning, and which afford basis for a history dealing with facts." In other words, he has good sources, and I can deal with these things and write accurate biographies on them. Now that I've done this, I might well say of the earlier periods of which I'm about to write, Theseus and Romulus, what lies beyond is full of marvels and unreality, a land of poets and fabulists, of doubt and obscurity. May I therefore succeed in purifying fable, making her submit to reason and take on the semblance of history. What Plutarch is saying here is, I had really good sources for these other biographies I've written, but now Theseus and Romulus, they're like 800 to 1,000 years ago. I don't have good sources for them. They're just fables and myths. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take those sources and I'm going to rewrite them to make them sound like accurate history, but don't be under any illusion that they are. Because he's writing about people who had lived 800 to 1,000 years before. So there's large-scale conjecturing when it comes to Theseus and Romulus, but not with these others who had lived within 140 years. What about the Gospels? When the Gospels are written, they're written within 20 to 65 years of Jesus' life. The eyewitnesses are still alive, many of them are, when these Gospels are being written. So the living memory, there's living memory of Jesus when all these Gospels are being written. There's no need for large-scale conjecturing. So they had the ability to write accurate history. Number four, the author or their sources were capable of recalling stories accurately. We talked about the large-scale conjecturing, but also we have the item of memory. Now, of course, memory is not perfect. We all forget things. We misremember things. At least that's what my wife tells me. I didn't get that right. And my wife has a better memory than me on a lot of things. She can remember details on things a lot better than I can, like what was said at certain times by a certain person. Memory, I got you on that. Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying here with your laughs. But memory is generally reliable. Now, several years ago, I was in a doctor's office, and I just had an appointment. I came out of the office, and I'm walking out, and the office is just jammed with other patients. And there was this one guy, he was an old guy, and he was wearing his baseball cap, and it had a B-29 Super Fortress embroidered in it. So he's a World War II vet. And my wife and I, we love World War II stuff. We just can't get enough of it, watching documentaries and movies on World War II. And so I saw this guy, and I'm thinking, that's just amazing. And I walked out of the doctor's office, and then I just couldn't let it go. And so I came back in, and I walked up to the guy, and I said, "Sir, did you fly on a B-29 in World War II?" And he said, "I sure did, son." I said, "Wow, you must have some amazing stories." And he said, "Yeah, I was in the Pacific Theater, and I'll never forget the native women on the island on which we were stationed. They had a horrible odor to them." So here he was, decades later, more than half a century later, and he could remember that these women stunk. How many of you were old enough to remember 9/11? Okay, lots of you. Do you remember what the weather was like on that day? What was it? Well, of course, it's Tucson, you know. Sunny. It was sunny everywhere in the U.S., okay? Here it is. You remember what the weather was like on 9/11 19 years ago. Now, how many of you remember what the weather was like September 11th this year, just a little over a month ago? Yeah, it was hot. It's Tucson. Yeah. Okay, but I ask this almost anywhere else in the country, and they'll say, I don't know. Why is it that we can remember what the weather was like on 9/11 19 years ago, but we can't remember, you can, of course, down here in Tucson, but we can't remember what it was like a little over a month ago, 5 weeks ago? Because we tend to remember things in which either we were involved or that impact us emotionally. In November 1965, you had a battle at the Yadrang River Valley in Vietnam. It was the first engagement of U.S. forces with North Vietnamese Army. This is recounted in the movie We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson and Sam Elliott. And it was based on a story, a book written by Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore, that's represented by Mel Gibson in the movie, and Joe Galloway, who was a combat reporter. They wrote a book, and then the movie was made out of it. And so it talks about these harrowing 5 days of battle that took place. There were a lot of American casualties involved, and I mean, it's a great story. It's a fantastic movie. And so Joe Galloway, this combat reporter, the real one appeared in a documentary called Vietnam in HD. And my wife and I were watching this a few years ago, and in the very first episode, he appears there, and he's talking about his experience during those 5 days. And at one point, he says something. It's a one-minute clip, and I said, that's amazing. And so I got that one-minute clip I want to show you. Here it is.
Knowing that young Americans had laid down their lives so that I might live. They had sacrificed themselves for me and their buddies. What I was learning was that there are some events that are so overwhelming that you can't simply be a witness. You can't be above it. You can't be neutral. You can't be untouched by it. Simple as that. You see it, you live it, you experience it, and it will be with you all of your days.
Let's say that you had been with Jesus, you had traveled with him. Maybe you were one of his disciples, maybe you were one of the women followers, and you had actually seen him give sight to a guy who had been born blind. You saw him take a person who had been paralyzed for years and heal him so that he could get up and take up his bed and walk. You saw him walk on water. You saw him raise a dead person. You saw him engage the Jewish leadership in arguments. You saw him crucified, and shortly after, you saw him raised from the dead and in perfect health. Do you think that that would leave an impression on you that was as deep and lasting as those 5 days had on Joe Galloway? That's Jesus' deeds. What about his words? You know, most of us don't think about this, but Jesus was an itinerant preacher. He's not like my friend Adam, a pastor who was very kind and bought me a cup of coffee before here. And Adam, as a pastor, he's got to come up with a new sermon every week, a different sermon every week. An itinerant speaker like myself, Frank Turk, we were talking about this the other day, my buddy Frank, he said, you know, we've got maybe a dozen or so talks, and we just give them the same talk in Tucson as we gave in wherever we were the week before or the month before that. We give the same ones. We don't have to come up with a new talk every time because it's a different audience every time. Jesus was an itinerant speaker. He probably had a dozen or so messages, and he taught those messages over and 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 over. And of course, his disciples, then he sends them out because they've heard him all these times, and you've heard the best way to learn something is to teach it. Some of them probably took notes. It could very well be that Matthew took notes. He took down the teachings of Jesus, and that is the Q source we have. I think there's a good possibility of that. You've got this they hear it, they go out, and they're teaching the same things over and 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 over. They come back, they debrief Jesus, and he says, hey guys, guess what? Now let's go to our next level. Do you know that when you're talking to Gentiles, you can adjust these parables a little bit and the stories in order to do a cultural translation and appeal to them more and communicate with them better than when you're doing with Jews, because you can just change up things? And so he teaches them, and he says the same stuff over and over and over and over and over. And then he rises from the dead. He leaves them after a while. And now for the next several decades, they're teaching the same things over and over. And you get the message. You get the idea. Jesus' teachings is not something they heard just once and they're trying to recall 35 years later. They're teaching this stuff all the way up until the time, and even after the Gospels are being written. Patrick Henry's famous liberty or death speech. Do you know that there's only two eyewitnesses of that who recounted them later? There's no notes that have survived from Patrick Henry of what he said on that day. The only way we know what he said are two eyewitnesses who were trying to recall it from memory 41 years later. Now, maybe he said, give me liberty or give me death and so forth. But the rest of it has been reconstructed based on their memories. They've taken it, and the guy who wrote, reconstructed it, took a lot of liberties in reconstructing what that actual was said. In that, he's given us a gist of what occurred based on what those two eyewitnesses were recounting 41 years later. I can tell you that we can have more confidence that the Gospels are preserving what Jesus said than when we read about Patrick Henry's liberty or death speech. That's pretty cool. So they were certainly capable of reporting accurate history. Number five, we want to be able to verify numerous reported items in the literature. Let me just give you a few reasons for thinking we can do this with the Gospels. Many of the items reported agree with existing background knowledge. It's just like what we heard from our previous lecture here on the archaeological evidence with the Israelis or the Jews leaving Egypt, okay, the Exodus. So a lot has to do with verisimilitude based on what the evidence that we have, our background knowledge. We've got this with the Gospels as well. So, for example, when it comes to names, you know, we find a lot of the same names that we know existed at that time. So Palestinian Jewish names in late antiquity, Tau Ilan in Israeli, and Richard Baucom, a New Testament scholar, have done extensive research on this, and they find that a lot of the names that we have in the Gospels were common names of Palestinian Jews in that period and not those of diaspora Jews, those who were outside of Palestine. They had other names that they used. The names we find in the Gospels are those who were within Palestine, Judea at that point. They also appear with roughly the same frequency in the Gospels as we find in the extra-biblical data, inscriptions and other things like Josephus and Philo. And this suggests that the Gospel authors were well acquainted with Palestine or Judea in that period. Then you've got persons. The persons mentioned in the Gospels, these were people who actually existed. You've got places. The places that we find in the Gospels, these are just some of them. We know that these places, they're not fictional places, they actually existed. Procedures, a lot of things like the crucifixion and burial practices of crucified victims, whether they were left on crosses. We know that in Jerusalem, this was not the case. We know from archaeological data, we know from Josephus, that the Romans allowed the Jews to remove the crucified. Josephus mentions this specifically. Prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, they allowed the Jews to remove the crucified and give them a proper burial prior to sunset. We've got confirmation of many items about Jesus from the Gospels that we do in historical Jesus research. And number six, only a very small percentage of the reported items have a reasonable chance of being errors. Okay. Now, hear me here. I'm not saying the Gospels have errors in it, but I'm saying in order to establish that they are historically reliable, they don't need to be inerrant. Historically reliable is a different kind of standard. So, and it's not with inerrant. So, like, for example, are the Psalms inerrant? Are they divinely inspired? Sure. But are they historically reliable? Not a trick question. But no, we wouldn't say they're historically reliable. We wouldn't say they're historically unreliable. It's an illegitimate question. It's the wrong genre. It's not a historical genre. Be like saying, does the color blue meet EPA regulations? You don't ask whether the Psalms or the Proverbs are historically reliable. You don't ask if parables are historically reliable. They're not historical genre. But you could have a historical literature like, say, Sallust's War with Catiline, and you can say, is this historically reliable? You can say, yes, but it's not divinely inspired. These are historically reliable, inerrant, inspired, are different questions. We're seeking to answer here, do they meet the minimal standards of being historically reliable? And one of the criteria is, we don't want more than just a small percentage of things reported to be false. Now, when we come to the Gospels, there are a handful of candidates that are reasonably good candidates for being errors. We can't establish that they are errors, and there are people who have tried to reconcile these and explain them, and those explanations may be correct, they may not be. We just don't have a way of verifying them. But some of them are really difficult, such as the death of Judas. Matthew said he hanged himself. The book of Acts says that he fell headlong and his guts burst open and died. Okay, well, these seem to be contradictory. Now, someone said, yeah, he hung himself, the rope broke or the branch broke, and he fell down and burst his guts open and intestines came out. Yeah, well, maybe. Seems ad hoc, seems like a stretch. Besides, if the rope or a branch breaks, do you fall headlong or do you fall on your butt? Oh, well, he fell on his butt and then he tumbled. He was on like this steep hill. He fell on his butt and then he tumbled head first down. That's how he did it. I mean, it gets to be hermeneutical waterboarding until you get the text to tell you what you want to hear, right? And I'm not really for wanting to do that. So I'd say it's a reasonable candidate for an error. Doesn't mean that it is, but at least we have to admit it's a reasonable candidate. The census of Caesar Augustus mentioned, that's another one. There's a handful of these. None of them impact any doctrine. These are all just minor details in the peripherals, okay? But we only have like a handful of these in the Gospels. Very small percentage. All right, so let's summarize. Historically reliable, we've defined this to say, at minimum, it provides us with an accurate gist. In other words, it gives us an essentially faithful representation of what occurred. We can trust that the main and essential parts in the Gospels are true. They meet these six criteria. And these criteria are, we have reasons to believe the gospel authors intended to report accurate history. We have reasons to believe that the gospel authors chose their sources judicially. We have reasons to believe that the gospel authors used their sources responsibly. We have reasons to believe that the gospel authors were capable of reporting accurate history. We have reasons to think that we can verify numerous items reported in the Gospels, and we also have reasons to think, number six, that no more than a very small percentage of the things reported in the Gospels may be false. And so therefore, the Gospels, as we're defining it here, they meet at least the minimal standard of being historically reliable. They could be far more than that, but they meet our standard, and thus we can say the Gospels are historically reliable. If you want more information, we've got our YouTube channel. Just go type in at YouTube, Mike Licona, L-I-C-O-N-A. We've got over 200 videos there, a lot of things that you can learn. We've got just a series we completed, 5 videos on the formation of the biblical canon. We've got stuff from Dan Wallace on manuscript evidence, the best English translations. We got stuff on the Gospel of Mark, which is some great stuff. Or you can go to my website. risenjesus.com, and I'm finishing 10 minutes early. So I tried to finish on time, but I finished a little early, talked a little faster today because I didn't want to run out of time. would it be possible for me to take some Q&A? Would that be okay? All right, thumbs up. Anybody got any questions, comments, snide remarks? Yes, sir. What is the earliest date for the writing of Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Well, the earliest, most scholars put Mark first, okay? And I think there's good reasons for that. And then you got Matthew and Luke. Well, if you're looking at the earliest datings, some of the arguments would be, well, Acts finishes with Paul still alive. He's in prison. I think it's Festus has just taken over, and I believe he took over in the early 60s as the Roman governor of Judea, the prefect of Judea. And so that would be the early 60s that they argue that Acts ends with Paul in prison there. Luke would have had to been written, and you don't have the fall of Jerusalem recorded, so it's still before 70, probably there mid-60s or a little bit before. Luke would have had to been written before that because that's the prequel to the book of Acts. And since Luke is using Mark, then Mark would have been still earlier. So there have been a couple of scholars, not too many, but a few of them who place Mark even as early as the 40s that they argue for that. But most scholars don't take it that way. I just had a student, I teach at Houston Baptist University, one of my students, he just did a master's thesis that I supervised, and he surveyed all what critical scholars writing in English since 1965 are saying about the dating of Mark. He had over 200 sources. By critical scholars, more than 200 critical scholars, and the majority think that Mark was written somewhere between 50 and 70 AD, with a majority of them placing it sometime between 65 and 70 AD. So that would place the Gospels a little bit later than the earliest dating of it, but the majority place Mark between 50 and 70, Matthew a little after that, Luke a little after that, and John around the year 95. Okay, but almost all scholars place the Gospels in the first century. We can't know, I mean, we can only have arguments for these things, but we really can't know for sure. We just know they're first century. Yes, sir.
John is written so differently than the others. Were there any other ancient biographers that did any kind of biography similar to John? And since his is so unique, does that even add more
Okay, good question. So the Gospel of John, as you've recognized and most scholars have, the Gospel of John is quite different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke are very similar. They're almost word for word on many occasions. They're referred to as the synoptic gospels, from two Greek words, soon meaning with, and opsis meaning see or view. So you can view these together. They're so similar. John, on the other hand, is very different. In fact, the conservative New Testament scholar N.T. Wright has said, I love this statement. He says, John reminds me of my wife. I feel about John as I feel about my wife. I love her very much, but I don't claim to understand her. John is very different. In fact, the conservative New Testament scholar F.F. Bruce said that what John has done is he's taking the traditions about Jesus. Remember, he's writing after maybe a few decades after Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and he says he's taken the traditions about Jesus and he's rewritten them so we have an expanded paraphrase, a translation of the freest kind, and a transposition into another key, and much more. That's F.F. Bruce saying this. Even Craig Keener has said in his commentary on John that all Johannine scholars, those who specialize in the Gospel of John, acknowledge some degree of Johannine adaptation. John has taken Jesus' words and recast them in his own words and expanded them to give us like a theological paraphrase. Have other authors done that? I suppose that they have, but John probably does it more than the typical biographer does. Why did he do that? We don't know. It could be that he looked and he probably knew about Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and he sees that they're pretty much reporting the same thing. Why does he need to just do another thing? So he says, okay, I've got these others. We got these. Let's do something a little bit differently. There are some things that people don't understand what Jesus said. So let me kind of take his words, almost like what we have in a paraphrase today. Let's take these words and I'm going to elaborate some to bring out the theological meanings of these teachings of Jesus. John takes some more liberties than the average biographer does in the way he reports things. Here's another thing. Most of what the, even though the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, report a lot of the same stuff, they're focusing on Jesus' ministry in Galilee. Yeah, they've got some in Jerusalem, but most of what they're reporting about Jesus is in Galilee, whereas John is focused on events that took place in Jerusalem. So that's some of the main differences between John and the synoptic gospels. Great question. Yes, sir.
Upon a Q document to write the Gospel of Matthew?
Oh, okay, good question. Why would Matthew have to use the Q source, the hypothetical Q source, to write it if he's an eyewitness? Well, in my view, I think Matthew is the author of Q. I don't know that for sure, but I think that Q, see, here's the Q. When you look at Q, it's almost exclusively all but three minor exceptions, all of it involves teachings, sayings of Jesus. It's not narrative form. It's almost all exclusively teachings of Jesus. So it could very well be the case that what Matthew did was, these are notes that Matthew took while Jesus was alive about Jesus' teachings, so he could take it along with him. He would have been literate as a tax collector. He's taking down Jesus' teachings, and he's writing them in Aramaic, which would have been his main language, and these are the teachings of Jesus. Later on, after Mark writes his gospel, they're after Matthew. You're an eyewitness. Hey, tell us about Jesus. So he has a secretary. Secretaries were used widely in antiquity. Cicero, the great Roman rhetorician and lawyer and orator, he had a secretary named Tiro. In fact, he writes to Tiro once when Tiro was away, and he says, Tiro, I just had Pompey, the great Roman general Pompey, over, and he asked me to read something I had recently written, and I declined because I said Tiro had not had a chance to improve it. So you have Cicero has a secretary who does a whole lot more than take dictation. He does a lot of serious editing. When you come to Paul, in at least three of his letters, he says, I, Paul, who write this greeting with my own hand, which means he didn't write the rest. You say, well, wait a minute. He could have dictated that letter, okay? Well, my friend Randy Richards, who teaches at Palm Beach Atlantic University, he teaches on this. He's an expert on this kind of stuff, on secretaries. And he says, let's look at what you got here. He says this, I do this with my students. I take a piece of papyrus, I give it to all my students. And then what I do is I give them some ink and a reed, and I say, okay, I want you to take down, and I'm going to dictate to you what I want you to write. Ready? Paul, an apostle, 1 minute later, of Jesus Christ, 1 minute later, by the will of God. Can you imagine doing a whole letter that way? No, they took notes, they constructed, composed the letter, they let Paul read it, Paul makes some adjustments, and he says, all right, write the final, I sign my name to it. Now, if Paul, who's highly educated, and Cicero, highly educated, are going to do this with letters, don't you think the gospel authors, who are uneducated fishermen and so forth, are going to do this with a more extensive biography? That biographer is going to take notes and then construct that. The gospel author then is going to read it, make, you know, other suggestions and so forth. Matthew probably tells his secretary, you can use Mark as your primary source. Let's supplement it. Here's my Q source, the sayings of Jesus. You can use these, translate them into Greek, and here's some more eyewitness testimony from me you can use. Does that make sense? Great. God bless you guys. Thanks for having me.